Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, inviting you to join us for the 2012 Michigan State University Homecoming, happening the week of October 8th through 13th in East Lansing. This year's theme is Spartans Will Make History, a celebration of MSU's storied past and the amazing Spartans who have contributed to our legacy of advancing knowledge and transforming lives. We'll be honoring 10 superlative Spartans at MSUAA's Grand Awards Gala. Athletic Director Mark Hollis will serve as Grand Marshal for a homecoming parade with over 100 entrants. You'll have the opportunity to meet the 2012-2013 MSU Homecoming Corps. And of course, there's all the tradition and fun of a Spartan football weekend, from the green and white brunch to tailgating to the Spartan marching band's procession from Adams Field to Spartan Stadium, and of course, the big game between MSU and Iowa. On top of it all, we'll be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, that amazing piece of federal law that made land-grant universities like MSU possible. And wherever you might be, don't forget to install those green bulbs in your porch lights and join all of us here in East Lansing as we glow green. Mark the week of October 8th through 13th on your calendar and make a date to join us for Michigan State University's 2012 Homecoming Festivities. It will be an experience you'll never forget.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today with Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. President Simon, let's start with you. Tell us about MSU and MasterCard Foundation partnering on a $500 million African Scholars Program.
Well, the MasterCard Foundation has committed $500 million to be spent over a number of years to support Africa. This reflects their confidence and excitement about the youth of the continent, as well as its extraordinary future. So the first part of this was to support a couple of institutions in Africa, and then MasterCard will announce $100 million of that $500 million going to support children, young people from disadvantaged backgrounds in Africa. Michigan State University will receive $45 million of the $100 million, supporting the largest number of students in both graduate and for undergraduates as well as graduate students, and will serve as a hub for this group of institutions. The institutions include Arizona State, but also Stanford, Duke, Berkeley, and Wellesley.
And what's sort of important for Spartans to know about it and what it will do?
Well, it's consistent with our land-grant spirit that students from economically disadvantaged backgrounds with enormous potential, not simply to graduate from college but to be the global citizen scholars, should have an opportunity to attend one of the world's great universities, and it happens to be Michigan State. It's also a recognition of the long-standing commitment that Michigan State has to the continent of Africa, really dating back to John Hanna's work in the 1950s and 60s. The students that we have, the two undergraduate students are here right now who came as an anonymous scholarship. One is from Ghana and one is from Senegal. And we have graduate students from Mozambique, Ghana, Zambia, and Uganda, so representing the countries that will lead the African Revolution.
And Mark, you and your wife Nancy recently announced a gift back to your alma mater. Tell us about it and what motivated it for you.
Well, first of all, it's an honor for us, but I think it should be pointed out that all gifts that Michigan State receives are valuable, no matter what their denomination or what the purpose is. I think for Nancy and I, her in the study abroad program, myself in intercollegiate athletics, it was an opportunity for us to learn many things after we returned in that the education we received was not only due in part from the dollars that our parents provided, but really came from those that walked before us and provided contributions back to Michigan State and creating opportunities. So as we are blessed to have the positions we have on campus, we gave some reflection and came up with some purposes that in our minds are very symbolic to our past, and that's providing a gift for scholarships, for the arts, and half of our gift is going for that purpose, for a scholarship endowment that will go to a student from the state of Michigan, which was important to me because of our roots growing up here, giving back to the state of Michigan was part of that objective. The Wharton Center has been a beacon in mid-Michigan for the arts, and it's going to be enhanced dramatically by the Broad Art Museum, and we felt it was an appropriate time to be on the front end of another beacon in mid-Michigan, and we're very proud to be part of that. The other half is going to athletics, yet it's going to a facility that I believe touches so many different parts of what we're trying to accomplish. Operationally, very much a needed facility for student athletes, for media, for game officials that are part of the operation, but more importantly, a room that's going to be a welcoming center for student athletes in 25 sports. It's a room that can be used by campus as a welcoming location, and enhancements to the public areas with restrooms and concessions. So as you look at the totality of that facility, it touches so many different aspects of what is important to myself as an athletic director, but to myself as an alum. And, you know, we're extremely proud to have the resources to be able to do this. At the same time, I think it demonstrates a reach gift. We are pushing ourselves very hard with the gift, and we believe that we have a plan in place to very much accomplish some positive things at Michigan State, which is what we desire to give back.
And President Simon, this is consistent with what you were mentioning to me yesterday, this culture of giving at MSU, right, from the staff all the way up to the Izzos, the Hollises, the D'Antonios. Talk about that.
Well, I think, first of all, the Hollis family gift is an extraordinary gift. And shares, I think, the family's deep love for Michigan State and the recognition, as Mark has said, about the role that Michigan State has played in their success. It's interesting that Michigan State, from its faculty, staff, retirees, typically outperforms our Big Ten peers in terms of the contributions. I think that's because of this deep connection and the sense that people are really a part, not simply of a great legacy, but of a great future for Michigan State University. The other thing I would say about the Hollis family gift, and I guess it mirrors a bit the philosophy of many donors. This is a significant gift. It will be announced at $1 million. Has a deferred or a planned component as well as a cash component for families as young as the Hollises. That's a terrific way to think about making a major impact to Michigan State. And the more successful they are over their lifetime, it's typically our experience that those gifts grow and they don't decline. And also the fact that it's a blend of athletics and academics is typical of a lot of donors at Michigan State and reflects that while any college or any program always wants all the money, it's sort of their natural inclination to say, gee whiz, you know, I'd like it for myself or my special program. What it reflects is that there are many ways in which the institution has a dramatic impact, and leaders like Mark and Nancy, hopefully their children as they graduate from Michigan State, will see that we are really Team MSU, and we grow together. It's not growing one part at the expense of another. We grow together. And so this gift really reflects both, as Mark said, the symbols that are very external to Michigan State, but not simply athletics, but the Wharton Center and the Broad Art Museum, this new facility that will be critical for the university in the same way that the now Huntington Club is viewed as a university asset, even though it was designed to be able to support a club and some suites for football games. It's now a university asset. And so will this new facility that will be on the north end of Spartan Stadium. And then all of us want to make sure that we recognize that our success is the product of others. And scholarship support is the greatest way to be able to have people's dreams come true. And the dream should be to attend a world-class institution like Michigan State from whatever background you come from Michigan. And the gift, the scholarship, will permit that to happen. So it really is a package, I think, of Michigan State values. I think it's very unusual that you have an athletic department, Mark's leadership, but also the Izzo family gift, the D'Antonio family gift, and there are other gifts that have come from aspects of people in athletics that are not on the public radar scope that shows that they believe in Michigan State.
And Mark Hollis, this blend that President Simon talks about of your gift speaks to really something you stated when you got this job about wanting to bridge the academic, at least perceived, gap between the two and really bridge academics and athletics.
It was kind of a statement that I made that, you know, what will make you the proudest at the end of your career, and it would be that faculty on our campus have maybe not a love for athletics, but respect what the athletic department is trying to enhance. And that story was kind of brought to light here just recently with, you know, technology and emails, one from a faculty member who expressed some concern about the stature of intercollegiate athletics on our campus. And after a two-point email exchange, I stepped out of my chair and walked down to this gentleman's office, and he would enter the conversation with his ego, and I would enter it with my ego. And we sat down for 30 minutes, and at the end of that conversation, I think we both walked away with the perception that if athletics is the greatest athletic department in the country, we're not a great university. But if the College of Agriculture is the greatest ag program in the country, we're still not a great university. But collectively, if we can build each other up, if we can build up and have the finest art museum, the finest performance center, the finest college, whether it be education, ag, or all the way through, that then collectively we're all achieving the highest potential. And by the end of that conversation, I met several other individuals within that same department, and it was kind of a light bulb moment, I think, for both sides that, you know, okay, I do see the value. I do appreciate the value. And what's good for every individual is good for the whole collective of Michigan State University.
I think it's hard if you think about the coaches we've interviewed. And one of the things that they comment on regularly is that they feel as if they can go to anyone in the athletic department and get help or support. It's still in a context where athletics has a limited budget, and if somebody gets more money for scholarships, somebody's going to get less. Mm-hmm. But what is dominating the culture is not that sort of zero-sum game of what the economic pie may look like, but the possibilities that grow from collaboration and cooperation. And in a world in which, for families, for universities, resources are always going to be less than your dreams, because you would want faculty and staff who have terrific dreams, and you want students to have big dreams. So by definition, there's always going to be a gap between what you have in terms of tangible resources or dollars and those dreams. And also, there's an inevitable sort of allocation strategy that in any given moment in time, somebody gets a little bit less than they think they deserve. And because we have such great people, everybody probably gets less than they really deserve. But if we can, as a university, as Team MSU, recognize that that doesn't define us. That may define our budget, but it doesn't define who we are and what we're about. And the conversations that Mark just talked about, the fact that we can celebrate values and success, whether it's an FRIB or an art museum or a really neat book that was written that's going to be get national acclaim that probably nobody will ever talk about on WJR, or, you know, or the fact that sports radio dominates all that we do. for some folks, and they can't see it and understand it, it's still part of us. And so what we need to do together as Team MSU is recognize that it's not necessary to understand everything or necessarily to value it as much as what I do or what somebody else does in science. But it is important that together we make a great university. And I think what we've tried to do, what Mark's done with his gift, is recognize that sense of togetherness and team. And we really do appreciate the leadership they're providing. And I think that if we can have the conversations, as Mark did with this faculty member, instead of exchanging email at 30 paces, we have probably also gained some additional understanding that we're all in this together. And that if one of us is really good, it's a halo effect on all of us, because they don't know all of us. They only know some of us. Whether you're the greatest physicist in the world, they don't know the biologist, and they don't know the mathematicians, and they don't know the humanists. But there's a sense that if they're really great, that other parts of us are also great as well, and that halo effect happens for athletics. The key is to keep the value set connected and to try to work as best we can to provide the same ethical framework, the same fiscal integrity framework, the same sense of how we care about students, whether you're a part of a department or whether you're part of athletics. And that's, you know, something we strive to do. We're never perfect, no matter where we are. And it's not just wins and losses. There are things that we need to do better. And if everybody's committed to being better, then we have the kind of university that will be great not only today but in the future.
Hear, hear.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
This is MSU Today. I'm Russ White with Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. You both have increasingly visible roles with the NCAA. I'd like to ask you about first, President Simon.
Well, he has a really new one.
you now chair what they call the NCAA Executive Committee. What is that, and what will your role be with that group?
It was essentially unknown until Penn State, I think. The Executive Committee represents all three divisions of the NCAA. And so in some ways is the overarching corporate board for the NCAA, working closely with President Emmert on everything from TV contracts. The chair of the executive committee was the chair of the search committee for President Emmert. So I'm hoping that I'll be in a position where President Emmert will be there for a long time. We won't have another Penn State, and the basketball TV agreement will stay in place, and so it'll be a pretty easy couple of years. But it does represent this sort of collective of the NCAA, an important, I think, voice in how to make the NCAA the ethical and support organization for our student athletes.
And Mark, you've got an exciting role at on the NCAA basketball tournament selection committee. Just give us a little peek.
But you also have another role as well.
That's less visible. Chairing the NCAA amateurism cabinet, which
that's
is
right.
one of the four cabinets. But we're blessed to have a number of Spartans in great leadership roles. And I think the complexity that many people don't understand is, as you're sitting in those meetings, you're one of 36 conferences. So as you think of the six BCS conferences, it's outweighed by many, many other areas. And it's the collaboration that has to take place under a big tent of trying to work through those issues. Shelley Applebaum serves on our championship cabinet for the NCAA, and we have a number of coaches that are on various rules. The one that's exciting is the NCAA basketball committee. It's a lot of hard work. It's not just sitting that one weekend and watching basketball games and drawing numbers up on the board with teams associated with them. It's a complex situation that deals with television rights, deals with operations and logistics, site locations. It's about 40 days on the road. And while you're doing that, you're managing your primary responsibility of leading the MSU athletic department, but you're also engaged in a heavy analysis of the world of basketball and how it relates. The thing I like about it is you're associated with nine other outstanding athletic directors and commissioners, and really becomes a resource on how to make things better at Michigan State, because it's a pool of individuals where there's very high confidentiality. You have to be hand in hand with everybody there. So as issues develop, it becomes a resource of individuals for you to bounce ideas off, or what would you do in this type of a situation. And being that there's nobody from the Big Ten, it gives you one, there's one per conference that kind of rotates through. It gives you a little bit more leeway and maybe some of the things that you can share and seek counsel on. So I get great value in that. But going into my first year, I'm really looking forward. It's been a dream since hanging out with Arnie Farron out at the University of Utah when he chaired the committee in 1986. So it's been a long time coming. Being a manager for Judd Heathcote, you know, I give a lot of credit to him for getting this opportunity, and of course the friendship with Tom. But I will be up to the task, and very humbled and appreciative.
Well, let me ask you both, A.D. Hollis and President Simon, as we leave the NCAA topic, what sort of concerns you about intercollegiate athletics, and what are you kind of optimistic about in the years ahead?
Anytime you have the opportunity to interact with student-athletes, both those who are current student-athletes or alumni, you really understand the value of intercollegiate athletics to their life and their life skills. And so that's what we're really all about at the core. And so our collective responsibility is to keep that at the core of our work, even though we have become a sports-obsessed society and one that sport has taken on, including collegiate athletics, a higher entertainment value, that we have to sort of keep focused on that core, recognizing that we can't go back 20 or 30 years and peel off the entertainment component of this and as some faculty might like to go back to a what they would view as a purer state. So we have to then figure out how to reconcile on a day-to-day basis and on a policy basis these two sometimes competing ideas and competing tensions. And at the same time, we also have to recognize that the pressures of resources in the concept of the big tent of the NCAA have caused us to create rules and processes and some other things that may have deflected from the focus on the really fundamental issues of integrity and integrity in sport to get that sort of competitive edge. And so we're working through those issues now in ways that cause us to want to take a hard look at ourselves, not because what we're doing is inherently bad. It's just that it doesn't meet the kind of standards that intercollegiate athletics should have for our student-athletes today and tomorrow, and for, I think, the way in which sport needs to be reflected in the ethics of society.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's when you get to a core, college athletics is supposed to be students playing sports. And we judge college athletics, I think, a little bit too much through a select number of sports, and within those sports, a select number of individuals. And it's a profit and loss decision-making process rather than a collegiate competition process. And it's you know, at times you sit back and it's disheartening, yet you also see all of the values and the positives that come back to campus, come back to alums, are presently given to student-athletes. But as athletic directors and presidents, and we are in this together, very much so, it's looking on our horizon of how are we going to make decisions to continue to have the right return back to campus, and it's defining what that right return is. And, you know, I think many individuals in this business have put that focus in the right place, and I think the shift is starting to occur. President Emmert is dead on many of his comments that he's made, and it's continuing that dialogue and continuing that discussion. But if you can go to its very core, students, competing for their university as an extracurricular activity. That's what it's supposed to be.
You are being updated about all things MSU from Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear our conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
Up next, my all-time favorite journalist, retiring Detroit Free Press Associate Editor Ron Zwankowski.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, inviting you to join us for the 2012 Michigan State University Homecoming, happening the week of October 8th through 13th in East Lansing. This year's theme is Spartans Will Make History, a celebration of MSU's storied past and the amazing Spartans who have contributed to our legacy of advancing knowledge and transforming lives. We'll be honoring 10 superlative Spartans at MSUAA's Grand Awards Gala. Athletic Director Mark Hollis will serve as Grand Marshal for a homecoming parade with over 100 entrants. You'll have the opportunity to meet the 2012-2013 MSU Homecoming Corps. And of course, there's all the tradition and fun of a Spartan football weekend, from the green and white brunch to tailgating to the Spartan marching band's procession from Adams Field to Spartan Stadium, and of course, the big game between MSU and Iowa. On top of it all, we'll be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, that amazing piece of federal law that made land-grant universities like MSU possible. And wherever you might be, don't forget to install those green bulbs in your porch lights, and join all of us here in East Lansing as we glow green. Mark the week of October 8th through 13th on your calendar and make a date to join us for Michigan State University's 2012 Homecoming festivities. It will be an experience you'll never forget.
MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that AgBio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU AgBio Research. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU AgBio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU AgBio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU AgBio Research is changing the face of science.
MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Well, what a pleasure it is to welcome back one of my all-time favorite journalists, Ron Zwankowski from the Detroit Free Press. Unfortunately, a little bit bittersweet because he's retiring, but Ron, welcome back to MSU Today.
Thanks, Russ. Always great to be on this campus.
So long, 40 years in journalism and last several at the Free Press, editorial page editor, associate editor, sort of just talk about why now and reflect on what it's like to retire.
Well,
from something you love. From, you know.
It's something I love. I have been very blessed to be able to honestly look forward to going to work every day. And it has been such an ongoing education. Every day learning something, and then my job is to learn something and explain it to people. That's one of the simple ways to describe what a journalist does. Learn something and explain it to people. And it has been a tremendous ongoing education. However, having just passed 60 years old, and it is also a profession that demands an enormous amount of time. And I just, with whatever time I have left, you know, we all come with expiration dates, Russ, and we don't know what those expiration dates are. But with it, whatever time I have left, I have given so much of my time over the years to this business and this profession. I had to make a decision about how I want to spend the rest of my time. And I hope to be spending a lot more of it with family and my own little support system that made it possible for me to do this job over the years.
What about retirement in general? I mean, I hate to say I'm inching a little closer myself, but just I hear people say sometimes it can take up to a year to adjust. What are you just sort of thinking about being a retiree?
I expect it will be particularly awkward when there are major news stories. I actually had an invitation to be outside the state of Michigan on the first weekend in November, and I instinctively said, no, I can't. That's election weekend. And then I realized, the election is not my problem. All I have to do is vote this time. I just have to be an interested and concerned citizen, and I hope I will always be that. But I do anticipate that there will be some period of adjustment. And then after that, I don't know. I don't have any great plans, but if there's some way that I can use my talents to contribute to the greater good of Michigan, I hope to be able to do that.
Well, you do explain things very well, like you said. So if there's anyone who I hope does a blog, I hope it's you once you sort of settle into retirement. But Ron Zwankowski, let me ask you, over that, I'm sure, never a dull moment career of is there ever a dull moment in news, but is there a story or two that for whatever reason maybe impacted you more than some others?
Well, on August 16th of 1987, I was directed to head out to Metro Airport and was among the first reporters on the scene at the crash of Flight 255, which I believe remains the second worst air disaster in history. And having the opportunity to cover that story, but then also seeing the impact that that had, and that all those lives that were lost and the stories of how all of those people ended up on that plane at that moment, at that terrible point in time, always put me in mind of the Thornton Wilder story, the bridge at San Luis Rey, where four people end up on a bridge and the bridge goes down. And how did they all happen to be in that place at that time? And it has been an ongoing fascination of mine, I think, since that night about all the factors that end up putting us where we are at some point in time where things happen that all of a sudden catapult us into the news. And it's an endlessly fascinating, and you know, they say everything happens for a reason. We all are where we're supposed to be when we're supposed to be there for various reasons. And that has been an enduring fascination of mine.
And Ron, how has journalism changed most in your career? Now, obviously most people think of newspapers and journalism as the same thing, but I'd like to hear if you think they really are, but sort of what's changed over the years?
Let me go back to that terrible night in 1987 when I had an enormous story in my notebook, and my job was to get it to the Free Press in downtown Detroit, about 30 miles away. I couldn't find a telephone. And that today is so bizarre to even conceive of, where people are not only carrying telephones in every pocket, sometimes two phones, but they're also carrying the internet. They're carrying enormous sources of information on portable devices. I had to, and I had to do this many times, I had to persuade people to let me come into their living room and use their phone to place a collect call to the news desk at the Free Press and to dictate the story to somebody who would then rewrite it into something that was published in the next day's newspaper. Nowadays, you would probably end up either typing the story into a portable computer, instantly sending photographs from cell phones, sometimes text messaging entire parts of a story. We would be expected to tweet 140 characters of breaking developments, which would be instantly posted on the Free Press website. So the whole notion of, as the communications industry changed so drastically so that people are never out of touch, well, now they expect to never be out of touch with the news. So if you're delivering news, which is what journalists do, there are so many more different ways to deliver it now. And that's been something that you really have to keep on top of and keep up with. And that has been the biggest change. A newspaper is now only part of what the Free Press does. Now we are a newsroom that delivers news on all kinds of multiple platforms, and people consume it in all kinds of ways. There was a study out just recently. I believe it said that 23% of American adults got news from a daily newspaper, 23%. But most of them, 70-some percent, were getting news from online sources on a given day. So then I say, well, where does all that news in those online sources come from? It comes from newsrooms, and the biggest newsrooms are still, even as we're shrinking, are still operated by newspapers.
Well, Ron, what's the future then? More of this? I mean, you can only get so fast after a while, but where do you see it going in the next few years?
Well, when you consider that of people under the age of 35, if you ask them how many have read a daily newspaper, it's sometimes in single digits in some parts of the country, people under 35, people over 55 are still consuming news ink on paper, so to speak. But so we in journalism have to adjust for that. And I think probably in my lifetime, you will see the end of a daily printed newspaper product. I think you will see for many, many years to come the Sunday paper. I think that is part of sort of, even for younger people, that's an ingrained American tradition of getting information. But the notion of having a daily newspaper that is delivered to your home, when there are so many other quicker ways to deliver information to you personally, not just to your home, I think those days are probably numbered now. How far, 5 years, 10 years down the road, I think you will see the disappearance of that daily newspaper, but Sunday newspapers, I expect, will continue to survive.
Well, Ron, as we sit in the Dick Purton studio inside Gary Reed's studio suite here in the Communication Arts and Sciences building at MSU, what about these journalism students studying down the hall? What kind of skills, and I guess how many skills, do they need to hone to succeed in this new world?
The journalists that we are, and we continue to add journalists to the staff of the Free Press, even as we lose people to retirements. And I feel like I am part of a generation that is now passing the torch on to a new generation of journalists. And these young journalists are very skilled at delivering information across multiple platforms. And they need to be. They need to be very familiar with delivering information across multiple platforms. Where I find they are coming up short, and where I hope institutions like Michigan State continue to educate them, is in getting information, securing information, getting it correct information, and figuring out what's important to tell people. The reporting end of being a reporter, conveying the information, is something that comes very naturally to young people today on all sorts of platforms. But getting the information is something that I think the young people today need to work on. And how they will end up delivering it, you know, whether you may remember an old TV commercial where somebody was getting the news on the inside of their eyeglasses as they were reading it, there will probably be platforms like that. There will probably be ways that you'll get an alert inside your brain at some point that says there's a news story breaking somewhere. I don't know where it will all end up, because it is evolving and changing so, so rapidly. But my concern is, are we getting the correct information? Are we conveying the important information? Are we explaining to people how and why this will affect you?
I'm Russ White on MSU Today. My guest is retiring associate editor from the Detroit Free Press, Ron Zwankowski. Ron, let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff you brought up in your last column, which, if people want to look it up, ran on September 23rd. But you had a line in there where you said you believe we've entered another of those critical stages that will define this state for generations to come. Can you elaborate on that?
If you think about the history of Michigan, which began, of course, as a place, as a fur trading state, and was really defined by the waterways, because our water is what enabled people to get here, and our waterways were the first interstate highway system, if you will, were the waterways. So we began as a trading center with enormous natural resources, including lumber and animal pelts, et cetera, a great fur trading place for a long time. So there was that era. And then that evolved into, I guess, the lumber era, you would say, really defined Michigan, where Michigan provided the wood that was used to build so much of the country from our abundance of forests. And then came the motorized transportation era, where Michigan really literally put the world on wheels. We didn't exactly invent the automobile here, but we invented a way to make it accessible to the American public and around the world, made a huge difference there. And that was all part of the Industrial Revolution. And you look at the rise of the middle class, which happened in America. That was another era, post-World War II, where the middle class really took shape. So now everything has changed again, where we're into advanced manufacturing and high technology, and Michigan is on the brink of another era. And I think we are really at a crossroads as a state where we have to decide, are we going to embrace the kinds of things, notably education, that will enable us to remain a part of the progressive world going forward, or are we going to continue to complain that, doggone it, things just aren't what they used to be around here, and wish to go back to a period that will never exist again? And I think education at institutions like Michigan State is the key to getting us on that path. In the meantime, while we are about growing and developing the talent that Michigan will need to be a force in the economy of the 21st century. And really is talent is the driver of economic growth these days. If you have talent, money will flow toward talent. Investment will flow toward talent. Right now, Michigan has this amazing work ethic. And I've had many, many employers in other parts of the country and around the world say, we like to hire Michigan people because they show up. They come in, they work hard. We know how to do that. We're really good at that work ethic here. But are we the creative, innovative, relentlessly looking for better ways to do things? Are we bringing that to the table? And I'm not sure we're there yet. And education is the key to getting us there.
Ron Zwankowski, let me ask you about some of the things in your last column, too. And you've started to touch on them, but you sort of did things in Michigan that you love but that also drive you crazy. And I want to ask you specifically about water in a minute, because that's not something that really drives you crazy necessarily. But just kind of run through what you love and what makes you nuts about the climate, the sports, the politics, the people you sort of touched on.
When I was asked to write, I hadn't really intended to write a farewell column for the Free Press, but I had been writing columns every Sunday in the Free Press. I think it was, I ended up at 744 consecutive Sundays in the Free Press. And part of the reason for making sure I had a column in the Free Press every Sunday is that my dad, who's still alive, always went to church on Sundays and then picked up a Free Press. And if my column was there, he'd know I still had a job. So I was always worried. You know, he was a product of the Depression. Yep. And when you had a job, you don't give up a job. So I always made sure that I was there for him. That was my motivation. But as I was asked to write this last column and reflect a little bit on covering news in Michigan for 40 years, I realized that the things I love so much about this state are also the very same things that just make me crazy about this state. And it starts with the geography. We're a peninsula, which means we're a destination. Nobody gets here by accident. You have to want to come to a peninsula. You got water on three sides. Even whether you're in the upper or the lower or the thumb, you have to want to get here. You can't make a wrong turn and end up in Michigan. You follow a map, right, or a Google map or whatever.
That's right.
But you got to want to be here. And I like that being kind of a destination place. On the downside, what makes me crazy about being in a peninsula is that every time you want to go someplace, you first have to get off the peninsula to get to the rest of the country. So there's that. I love the weather and the four seasons, and I love the changeable weather, and I love being in a climate where things grow and change. And I think that's very emblematic of what Michigan needs to continue to do. We have a climate that enables things to grow and change here. On the other hand, weather can make you crazy. I mean, white snow, a nice covering of white snow where everything can make the landscape look terrific as you're coming up I-96. But then that's the countryside, and most people in Michigan live in cities, and that snow can get pretty ugly and pretty gloomy after, you know, around February. And so the weather, which I love the changeability of it, but at the same time, I also find it can make you crazy. What is it they say? If you want to enjoy all four seasons, come to Michigan, and you'll see them sometimes in the same day.
Right.
Or as somebody said to me once, come to Michigan, where summer, we hear, is going to fall on a weekend this year. But I've never been one to, I always like being in a changeable climate. So I do enjoy the climate here. And then the politics of Michigan.
Right.
I have met, over the course of covering a lot of politics, I have met and interviewed so many people. And I find Michigan politicians, by and large, genuinely concerned about wanting the best for this state. And really a committed bunch of people. And I refer to George Romney, who was the governor when I first came here. The first governor I personally covered was Bill Milliken. Covered a lot of governors since then, a lot of politicians, a lot of U.S. senators, members of Congress. And I all find that they are basically very well-intentioned people who could be doing other things, who could be making a lot better living perhaps in the private sector, but they're really committed to the state. Then there's the politics of division, which we have seen a lot more of lately, and I find that discouraging and frustrating where we used to talk about winning elections, and today it feels more like we talk about seizing power, and everybody wants to be in control, and we still have too many of the old divides that impede progress, and I refer to divides between the Detroit area and what's called outstate Michigan, divides between black and white Democrats and Republicans, business and labor, the east side of the state and the west side of the state. We are letting those divisions impede our progress. Fortunately, among younger people today. I don't see those divisions being nearly as pronounced as they used to be. So I'm fairly optimistic about that. And then I did mention it is great to live in a state where sports is such a prominent part of the culture. If we don't have the weather to talk about, we've got the Tigers, the Spartans, the Wolverines, the Titans. We've got lots of things that instigate conversations, some great rivalries at various places around the state. That said, sometimes we take it a little too far, and a hockey town hoodie is not always the appropriate dress to wear, as I'm sitting here talking to Russ in his Michigan State
shirt.
Right.
Well, and, Ron, what about water, though? If there's been a topic you've come back to several times in the last decade or so, is Michigan's water resources, and not giving it away or anything, but using those assets more wisely. What's your latest thinking on that?
I do think that Michigan is still missing an opportunity to become the world leader in water conservation technology. We're still a little bit in that industrial mode, and I think that this is a place where, and we've had some companies set up shop here, if you've got an idea to help the rest of the world save water, this is the place where you should be able to develop and grow that idea, because this is the place where you can afford to make a mistake with water. We've got an abundant resource. So I think we could be more of a leader in water technology. I also think that Michigan, water is still our biggest attraction. It's still the main reason for Michigan to be here, and we need to be very, very diligent about protecting our waters, our fishing resource from things like Asian carp, about making sure that the Great Lakes are not only the biggest natural reservoir of fresh water in the world, but also the cleanest. And Michigan, I never felt like we have stepped up to a leadership role in terms of protecting the Great Lakes. We have let other states take more of a leadership role, and we need to continue to do that. And that said, I also absolutely, I love living in a state where you're never more than 50 miles from a navigable body of water. I have been with, I'll never forget being with a group of German tourists, and there is a high spot. If you cross the Mackinac Bridge, there's a sort of a tourist attraction rock where you can go up to the top of the rock and look out and survey the Great Lakes. You can see where Lakes Huron and Michigan come together. And on a clear day, I think you can even see up to Lake Superior. And I was up there and happened to be with a group of German tourists who had no concept of a lake that you could not see from one side to the other, a lake where you couldn't see the end of the water. And one of them looked at me and said, "Is that an ocean?" And I said, "No, those are the Great Lakes." And they said, I don't remember the German expression exactly, but something like Süßwasser, sweet water. And I said, "The sweetest water in the world." And that's something we need to take care of.
Indeed. Ron, as we wrap up, just what sort of about any topic, because like you said, you're an observer and you explain things, but what sort of concerns you and what are you optimistic about that your kids and grandkids will be dealing with?
One of the things that I am concerned about, and it deals with the profession that I am leaving, is that as newsrooms continue to shrink, and really they're shrinking, they're also becoming a lot more efficient about different ways of delivering information. But as there are fewer people in the business and the occupation of journalism, I worry about the public getting the information that the public needs to make informed decisions. We cannot simply rely on government institutions to provide us information. We need people who will check and challenge the information we get from the government. And that is a core function of journalism. It's why they put freedom of the press in the very first amendment of the Constitution. We are always expected to play that watchdog role over public institutions. And these days we have fewer watchdogs. And that is one of the things that concerns me going forward. So I'm hoping that there will be a renaissance of journalism, perhaps in the form of bloggers, independent journalists, reporters of that kind. They will need the skills, though, the standards that we have practiced or tried to practice at the Free Press for 180 years. And I hope that that can be part of journalism going forward. That said, I'm optimistic, I think, about the future of the state of Michigan, because I have long believed that in this country we have too many people living in places where so many people aren't supposed to live. in uncertain environments. What is it, 80% of the population lives within 100 miles of one of our coastlines? Those are uncertain environments, naturally speaking, ecologically, environmentally speaking. And so I'm thinking that one of the great appeals of Michigan in terms of a place for economic growth is that it is a fairly stable environment. Four seasons, yeah, but no earthquakes. And no tsunamis and that sort of thing. We have an amazing reservoir of fresh water that a lot of places in the country don't have. We have a core of educational institutions that in one state I think is unmatched anywhere else on the planet to have in one state. So I'm hoping that that all of that becomes a sort of way for people to start thinking about why did we go to the Great Lakes in the first place back in the boom days of the economy back in the 50s and 60s? Why did we go there in the first place? You know, maybe we ought to look at going back there again.
Ron Swankowski, what's next for you? How can people like me stay in touch with what you're doing?
I would anticipate that I will be starting a blog after a period of decompression from daily news journalism. And I will certainly keep you all informed as to where that is. I can't imagine caring as much as I do about the state of Michigan that there will be things happening here that I won't want to have something to say about. I don't know whether anybody will care anymore what I have to say, but I do intend to keep a public voice of some kind. Other than that, my main intention is to pay back a lot of time. I remember when Kirk Gibson, an MSU alum, and of course a superstar baseball player, when he finally quit playing the game, when he finally retired, he said, I didn't retire, I was just traded to my family. And I kind of feel like the same thing. Now, Gibson, of course, got back in the game as a manager. I don't anticipate doing that.
Well, Ron, I'll look forward to that vlog once we give you some time to rest and recharge a little bit. But thanks for coming in and sharing your insights, as always.
Russ, always a pleasure, and go green.
Ron Swankowski, retiring associate editor of the Detroit Free Press, and I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
And to hear this conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career. People who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association. Your personal network for life.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM870 WKAR.